case will be Brian Thomas Smith v. Commonwealth, Mr. Broccoletti for the appellant, and Ms. Martin for the appellee. All right, Mr. Broccoletti, you have 15 minutes. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 5 minutes, please.
5 minutes it is.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is James Broccoletti from Norfolk. This is an appeal from the Circuit Court of the City of Newport News in which the defendant, Mr. Brian Smith, was convicted, among other things, of two counts of first-degree murder. The appeal focuses on the jury instruction that was given to the jury and approved by all parties. It's interesting that this is a 5A18 argument as well, which follows the case that the court just heard. It doesn't have anything to do with sufficiency, credibility of the witnesses. It's focused solely upon the instruction. And I concede from the beginning the trial counsel did not raise the issue or object to this particular instruction.
Is it your position that final paragraph in the instruction should have said that if the Commonwealth fails to prove either of the first two elements of the offense, you shall find the defendant not guilty?
It should say any of the above elements.
Well, nobody gets convicted of murder just because it's willful, deliberate, premeditated if there's no murder.
Well, correct. I understand that. But I think as we cited the model of jury instruction in our brief, the model jury instruction has the statement any one or more of the above elements. So, yes, that final paragraph is what's fatal.
It looks like this was a jury instruction that was originally drafted to include a manslaughter.
Well,
lesser included, but the judge didn't give that, and
right,
the instruction didn't get changed.
Correct, and I think that when you read the charge conference, which is included in the appendix, this aspect of the instruction was never addressed. No one ever discussed this. It was not even mentioned in the charge conference. They went off on issues of malice. They went off on issues of voluntary manslaughter, heat of passion, sufficiency of that evidence. And then they tried to craft instructions and mold instructions. And that's perhaps where the issue arose in terms of what the problem was, but it's clearly a wrong instruction. I don't think anybody can argue with the fact that this is an erroneous instruction. I think no one can argue also with the basic principle of law that it's presumed that a jury will follow the instructions given by the trial court. And this just isn't a corollary instruction. This is the core instruction. This is the finding instruction. This is what the jury has to look at to determine what the elements of the offense are. Counsel makes reference to the fact that, well, you have arguments of counsel and you have other instructions that were given to them, and those other instructions in the argument of counsel cure this particular error. We've cited the Lee case, which is a recent opinion from the Fourth Circuit, and I was glad to see Judge Petty refer to the Fourth Circuit before in the earlier argument, but the Lee case, I think, squarely is on point.
We read your stuff. We don't always agree.
Well, that's why I said that. I understand. But I suggest that Lee is persuasive in this particular opinion, in this particular aspect, though.
Counsel?
Yes.
How do you get past Turner? I mean,
on the second argument?
The Turner case, well, and essentially the Turner case can equally apply to the first one.
I think it applies to the second one clearly, and I think we've conceded in the brief that with respect to the decision of Turner that a panel of this court, I don't think, can overturn that. It has to be an en banc decision.
But you understand that's been affirmed by the Virginia Supreme Court.
I do.
Court.
I understand.
So we're certainly bound at this point.
I understand that, and I'm not devoting much, if any, time to that second part of the argument, because really, if the court agrees with us in the first turn, that second is moot, because that would be determined again once we get to the trial court.
But how does that not apply, follow up with Judge Decker's question, to this case, because the jury never got to that final paragraph? As a matter of fact, the jury never got to second-degree murder because they found all three of the elements have been established beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, I disagree. I think the jury has to read the instruction in entirety. You can't presume or speculate that the jury never read the last paragraph. The judge read it to them. That's in the appendix. The judge read them that last paragraph. Again, they're presumed to follow the instructions. They have to take the instruction as a whole as they read it. And they could have concluded that the Commonwealth proved, one, that the defendant killed Catherine Parker. They could have concluded, two, that the killing was willful, deliberate, or premeditated. But they did not have to conclude, in accordance with this final paragraph, that the killing was malicious. And, in fact, the other instructions that were given to the jury, in terms of inferring malice, use of a deadly weapon infers malice, all both contain the provision that say, unless you find beyond a reasonable doubt that malice didn't exist. So the jury had the opportunity, in conjunction with the other instructions, to find that malice wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt. They had the ability to read instruction 11 and 12 to say that malice wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and still have convicted the defendant of first-degree murder, which clearly isn't the law. So I suggest to the court that they have to read the instruction as a whole, especially when the judge reads them the instruction and gives them the instruction to take back. With respect to 5A18, I'd suggest that this case is on all fours with Campbell. I think it removes an element of the offense that the Commonwealth has to prove in order to find you guilty. This court, in an en banc decision in Campbell, found that a removal of an element of the offense in the instruction was cognizable, even though Rule 5A18 exists. And it's because, again, of the duty of the trial court. And the duty of the trial court is different. And the duty of the trial court is to give correct and accurate and complete instructions to the jury. Clearly, this instruction's wrong. It was given to the jury, and they could have convicted without the Commonwealth proving every element beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, before you sit down, what is your position as to harmless error? Talk a little bit about that.
I don't conceive of a circumstance under which a jury instruction which removes an element of the offense could be harmless error, especially when you consider that the element of the offense I think common sense tells you was lacking was the malicious aspect of it. And then when you read the other instructions, which allow them to determine that malice didn't exist, the jury can clearly conclude that there was no malice in this case in conjunction with all of the instructions, and yet still find the defendant guilty of first-degree murder.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, Ms. Martin.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. The jury was properly instructed in this case, and therefore the conviction should be affirmed. The first point that I would present is that although the finding instructions 11 and 12, one for each victim, could have been better worded, read with an eye to common sense and a logical interpretation, they did not leave out an element of the offense. They did not have the defendant be convicted of something that wasn't an offense. And so for that reason, it does not meet the ends of justice test. And since it wasn't objected to at trial, it should be barred here by Rule 5A18. And while the defendant talked about the Lee case, in which the court, the Fourth Circuit said, well, that closing argument doesn't overcome a flawed jury instruction, the cases that Lee relied on, Boyd, the U.S. Supreme Court from 1990, does say that arguments maybe carry less weight than actual instructions given by the court. But also, it says that the arguments of counsel and instructions of the court must be judged in the context in which they are made. And that case from Boyd also says at page 380-381, jurors do not sit in solitary isolation booths parsing instructions for subtle shades of meaning in the same way that lawyers might. Differences among them in interpretation of instructions may be thrashed out in the deliberative process with common sense understanding of the instructions in the light of all that has taken place at the trial, likely to prevail over technical hair splitting. And so if we look at this instruction and we look at it and analyze it piece by piece, what it told the jury was that the defendant was guilty of first-degree murder if the Commonwealth proved that the defendant killed the victims with malice, with premeditation, and that he was guilty of second-degree murder if he killed the victims with malice, but without premeditation. And if the Commonwealth did not prove that he killed the victims and didn't prove malice and didn't prove premeditation, then the defendant was not guilty of anything.
But so it's that last paragraph requires the jury to conclude the Commonwealth failed to prove both of those elements of the offense. I mean, maybe it's a strange, torturous reading, but that's what it seems to indicate.
Well, I think that you have to look at this again, because it's just inconceivable, using common sense, that the jury is going to find the defendant guilty if they thought he didn't do the crime. So even if they thought it might have been done by somebody else with malice or premeditation, if they find that the defendant didn't do it, they're not going to find him guilty of any offense.
But
I think that that's what we have to sort of focus on here in terms of, because also, and looking at the way that this case was argued, the defense theory was that the Commonwealth's witnesses were incredible and that he did not do the crime.
Well, under this instruction, under this case, which does not include the manslaughter instruction,
right.
If the jury found that the defendant killed the victim, but it was neither malicious nor premeditated, they would be required to acquit him, wouldn't they?
Yes.
So the last paragraph of the instruction says that they must prove that, or that they must find that the defendant didn't kill the victim.
I mean, right. Right, and that's the whole point of the case, and that's when you look at all the other instructions that were given, you look at, and that's why the argument of counsel to the jury becomes a factor to consider here, because his whole theory was the defendant did not commit this crime. You couldn't believe the Commonwealth's witnesses, and that therefore there was no evidence that proved that he did the crime. And that was his focus. There wasn't really a lot of discussion about whether it was malice, and certainly under the facts, it'd be hard not to find malice here, that these two people were shot in the head. The female victim was in poor health. She was sitting in a chair. She was shot at close range.
But when the Commonwealth elects not to instruct the jury on manslaughter, the judge is obligated to tell the jury that even if you find that the defendant killed the victim, he's not guilty of any crime unless these other two elements exist. I mean, the jury might think, look, if he killed the victim, he's got to be guilty of something. But this last paragraph talks about both elements of the offense.
Well, but I think that you have to read these things in order. That if you just had the first part of it, and then you had maybe the last paragraph, I think you'd have a different situation. But you have to read the first part of it, which talks about first-degree murder, and then you have the part about second-degree murder, and then you've already, because of the way it follows, that when you get to the second, if you're looking at the first part and they find no premeditation, so then they get to the second part, and then they find no malice. And so then they get to the last part, and that's when we go back to the defendant didn't kill the victim. And so if you read it in that order and you think about all the other instructions and the way it was argued and the way the evidence was presented, you can say that it is a logical reading that this instruction was not erroneously given. Now, certainly it could have been better worded, that it's, you know, they were trying to craft an instruction based on some of the model jury instructions, and they kind of put a couple of them together, but they didn't really do it correctly. But that doesn't mean that the judge was wrong in this particular case, or that this conviction should be reversed. Because, yes, it could have been better, but it's not the kind of error that requires reversal. And that's the point that I would make here. And certainly, with regard to the Turner case, because the jury did find that there was malice and there was premeditation, that it's just not likely that they were confused by the rest of the instruction. And so for that point, even though it could have been better worded, it would be harmless error under Turner. And that's a decision of the Virginia Supreme Court, as was noted. So this court really is bound by that decision. And I think that's really the focus of this argument. And certainly the Turner harmless error argument would apply to the voluntary manslaughter instruction as well. And there wasn't really any evidence that is going to support that instruction based on the facts of this case. And again, the defendant's theory was not that he had acted in any kind of self-defense. But certainly his evidence for provocation or mutual combat was based on the testimony of two of the Commonwealth's witnesses. For on one hand, the defendant said, well, these people are not credible. You shouldn't believe them because I really didn't do this crime. But on the other hand, if you are going to believe them, well, then believe the part about where I was somehow responding to something that happened when I went to get these drugs. And as the trial court noted, based on the fact that these people were shot in the head, one of them at very close range and the other one at a farther range, that it wasn't really not you know, in the back of the head, side of the head, that it was not mutual combat. So there wasn't the evidence to support that instruction. But clearly under Turner, that one would be harmless error. And the same argument would apply here, as I have said, that a logical reading of this instruction would allow this conviction to be affirmed. And then we ask the Commonwealth to that be done.
Thank you. Counsel? Mr. Broccoletti, I think
ma'am,
you have a few minutes.
Yes, ma'am. We're not talking about hair splitting. We're talking about a simple sentence that's reflected without any ambiguities whatsoever. I mean, there cannot be any doubt as to what that last paragraph requires. And the fair reading of that is that the Commonwealth has to, if they fail to prove it beyond reasonable doubt, the first two elements of the offense. So they could find that the defendant killed her, but they don't have to find that the killing was malicious under the reading of this instruction. And when you look at page 180 to 181 of the joint appendix, the other instructions about malice. You may infer malice from the deliberate use of a deadly weapon unless from all the evidence considered you have a reasonable doubt as to whether malice existed. Once the Commonwealth has proved there was an unlawful killing, you're entitled to infer there was malice in your consideration of the murder charges against the defendant, unless from all the evidence you have a reasonable doubt as to whether malice occurred. So the jury could have concluded very easily, based upon those instructions, read with this instruction, that the Commonwealth failed to present sufficient evidence to establish malice beyond a reasonable doubt, and still have convicted the defendant of first-degree murder. It's not a technical hair-splitting. It's a plain reading of the instruction. And the trial court has an affirmative duty, and I think they just got confused, and I think they're trying to mold instructions and put all these other manslaughter instructions together with this, and it produced an erroneous instruction which clearly affected the rights of the defendant.
Well, they couldn't have convicted a first-degree murder unless they found all three elements. That's
true. That's true. But then you have to read that in conjunction with the last paragraph. You can't eliminate the last paragraph. You can't say it wasn't read to them or they didn't consider it. They consider instructions as a whole. And the last paragraph tells them that they don't have to prove that the Commonwealth has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the first two elements. It requires them to consider that. And that's where I'm getting at the malicious aspect. I think common sense tells us that they concluded the defendant killed the two people. But the malicious aspect is clearly put in doubt by the language of that last instruction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.